the tabletop. Take away
game mechanics on display.
Three designers share the stage.
Pick a genre and we'll play
the tabletop. Take away.
Welcome back to the Tabletop Takeaway. I'm Trevor Muller-Hagel.
I'm Ananda Gunaratna.
And I'm Charlie McCarron.
And today we're starting off our first game in the Civilization-like games series, or Civ-like games. The core of Civilization games comes from, like, you know, Civilization, Sid Meier. Is it Sid Meier?
Yeah.
Yeah. That has been like a computer game version as well for many years, many implementations.
Although I think actually that one was based on a board game, if I'm not misremembering. So it's like, and then they made a board game of the video game, and I think it's going around in circles.
And the difficulty with a lot of Civilization-style games is that they take a long time because you want to go through the ages, which brings me to our first game. Through the ages. Sorry, I did not actually set myself up for that, but I'm pretty proud of it. So Through the Ages is predominantly just a card game where you have a tableau that you're building up your civilization over time. There's kind of a draft track of these different cards. You have different scaling of how many actions it takes to take these cards, depending on where it is in the track. As cards are removed, they all slide to the left, kind of the conveyor belt style. And as they get to the left, they become cheaper and cheaper. Ultimately, there's several types of cards. You have your starting like production buildings. Those can create food or materials. Then you have your urban buildings, which can create science and culture and happiness for your civilization. And then you have your kind of government, which tells you how many civic actions you have and how many military actions you have, and then how kind of robust your urban areas can be with kind of a building count. So those are kind of your core cards. And then you also have warriors or fighters, military cards. So that's what you kind of start with. You move immediately into getting a leader for your civilization. They kind of throw a bunch of prehistory kind of characters that you are like pre, you know, 2000s, pre 2000 years ago. So, BC, and it's really interesting because you're able to kind of grow these different core buildings up as well as branch into new kind of urban buildings, new kind of military units. You're producing food to create more people, which is almost could qualify as a worker placement game, but I wouldn't call it a worker placement game because you're actually permanently assigning them to a building until you destroy the building and get the worker back. So it's not quite worker placement, but you do have workers that get put into different buildings in your civilization, which could also be your military, growing your military might so that you can attack your, you know, adversaries or go colonize new areas or what have you. There's a lot going on in the game. You still can build wonders as well. There's technologies that you can unlock. So, it's very expansive, and it immediately starts diverging from the start. But you all have the same starting point. So it's really nice that you can all build from that same foundation and then just go in completely different directions. I would go into more detail, but I feel like that's a good overview for now. What do you guys think? Is there anything else specific we should go into?
We'll probably bring up the details as they come up. There's quite a lot going on in this game. I guess... To start bringing up details, I think one of the absolute coolest things about this game is how it represents resources and buildings.
Oh, yes.
Because essentially, you know, you've got these cards, and each of the cards represents a type of building. And you have your little yellow cubes, which are your workers
people.
Or your people, your population. And if you put a yellow cube on a card, it means you have a building of that type. And for the food and basic resource stone, whatever it is, production.
Yeah, materials.
You have these little blue cubes. And when you put a blue cube on one of those cards, it represents a unit of that resource.
Good.
Yeah, that good. Yeah. And this is really cool for several reasons, I think. One of them is that ergonomically, it's very clean. It's like, okay, I have two yellow cubes on that card, so I'll put two blue cubes on that card. Production is very simple. It also means that because the value of each blue cube is depending on the card that it's on, as you unlock technologies that produce more goods, you also have better storage automatically. Because one of the things about this is if you have too many blue cubes out on your cards, meaning you're storing too many resources, you suffer from corruption and you lose resources every turn. So better technologies both increase your production and increase your storage efficiency by letting you represent the same amount of goods with fewer blue cubes. It feels really cool and it works really well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same thing, like the yellow cubes represent the workers of these buildings, so you don't have 30 of these same cards coming out and cluttering up the space. It's just represented by a single cube. And that works for the urban areas too that are non-production or non-good based. But those obviously have their limit. But then they're also creating extra culture or science and technology or whatever, just multiplied by the number of cubes on that card. Which obviously, if you're not playing on a virtual tabletop like BGA, like we played, that can actually make it a little bit more intense in terms of tracking, I imagine. But did you already talk about the blue bank, which I also think is one of the more interesting things too?
Yeah, the corruption mechanics in the blue bank. But we can talk about that more.
Because it's really interesting. There's only three steps for that corruption track. There's the first group, which is six total cubes of the blue cubes. And then you have another five and then another five. So every time you hit through one of those groups, you are going to lose more materials at the end of your turn. So you're really incentivized on your turn to spend as much as you can, but you're limited by your civic actions, what you can do. And so it's like, well, if I use my civic action to get a card, then I don't have that to build a thing. What if I don't have people? Then I also have to recruit more people or get more people with food. And so that kind of tightness of how much you can do in a turn really makes you want to think your way through your problems and figure out what you're doing.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool.
Well, and I think that brings up one of the really big strengths of the game, which is that the game, a lot of this game is about not wasting opportunities, because every one of your turns is going to present you with opportunities that make you want to change what you're going to do. We haven't talked very much about event cards, but events may result in you gaining resources that you weren't expecting and now need to decide mm-hmm. whether or not to spend, because if you don't spend them, you will lose them to corruption. So you want to be spending your resources, but the market is also changing. You know, cards are coming off the market every turn, even if you don't buy them, because the two on the end of the market come off. So it's always sliding down, which means if you don't take a card from the market now, you will not get another chance to take that card. So that's another opportunity that you want to take. And then you also, you also have to think about, okay, well, I want a stronger military, so that events, we really should talk about events, but so that events will benefit me more. You want to up your production so that you're producing more. There are all of these opportunities, and the game asks you to not waste them.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that's really good.
And it does still allow you to have some sort of amount of planning too, because you see, it looks like 13 cards every turn. So you're seeing, like, just, you know, the last four are going to be three actions to take. So if you see something come out, maybe it's the next age's first card and it's really powerful and it fits exactly what you're trying to do, maybe you would grab that for a cost of three.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's really interesting how that's foreshadowing what might be coming down your way.
Yeah, I was going to say this market of cards, I think, is very cool, because it is all card types almost that you get to see. And I imagine that is one of the parts that makes the game most replayable. Because, like, being that this was my first game, I wasn't paying attention too much to what's far off and costing more actions to grab. But if I was paying attention a little more, I would probably be thinking, like, Then I, at, towards the end of the game, I realized, like, ooh, okay, I need to look ahead and see what military cards are even out there. And
yeah,
so I thought that was very cool. The other piece that I think was fun, once I realized it too, at, like we were saying about the, you put a yellow cube on something and it represents what you're going to produce every mm-hmm. turn. And I didn't realize, like, oh, okay, even the points are the producing every turn. So it really gives that feeling. That's maybe one of the key parts of a civilization building game, which is like some sort of engine building where you feel like,
yeah,
oh, as we go through the different tiers, they're going to start ramping up our production even more. That's well, very satisfying.
Yeah, and being able to invest early on in, like, a type of thing. Like, in this game, you can have theaters. And so maybe you start with the basic theater, and then you can keep advancing your theater. So you just have this chain of theaters. And because it's an advancement of the same technology, any workers you have in that first building, you can upgrade for a cheaper cost than just buying out that building outright.
Yeah, paying the difference.
Exactly. And so, like, you're just paying that small difference instead of just, you know, dropping 5 material. It's only 3 material or 2 material to go up to that next step. And that feels much more rewarding because it's like, oh, I did this strategy. So I'm saving resources and getting things stronger and following this line of logic. And now I've got this leader who amplifies that. And so it can really feel like you're trying to build a synergy in your civilization.
Yeah. I think the leaders. So one interesting thing. Given that the game is changing all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's all sorts of new opportunities. I think one thing the leaders do that's very important is they do let you aim for a particular strategy. Because in general, mm-hmm. the leaders will reward you by focusing on something. Like, for example, I had a leader that normally each wonder you build increases the cost of the next wonder. But I had a leader that means that that doesn't happen. So, like, I was kind of aiming for a strategy of, okay, well, get a bunch of wonders and build them, which didn't pan out because an event, which, okay, we need to talk about events, but an event came up and got rid of my leader before I could do that strategy a lot. So I think basically the game is all about tactics, and leaders give you a strategy to follow so that you have both of those, and you have to balance what's optimal for your strategy based on your leader with all of the opportunities that are coming up that you really want to take advantage of.
Right.
Yeah. And I think I was going to say, I think leaders are my takeaway for this because they, like you said, they steer you in a direction. And the interesting thing is that your leaders aren't going to stick around because sometimes they get phased out and,
or forcibly removed.
Yep. And I like that you have you also get the choice to even take a leader or not. And usually you probably want at least one leader, so that's giving you some sort of passive bonus. But unlike a game where it's like start, here's your asymmetric power for the start of the game and you're going to have this the whole game. It's like, no, you're going to have it for like a third or half of the game or something. And yeah, I think that's a cool way to do it.
Well, and not only that, it also encourages you to replace the leader yourself. Because if your leader just, I guess, dies because they're...
they go into a new age and they're you know, 200 years old.
Basically, if the leader is 2 ages behind the current age, they go away. I guess they retire. Maybe. But if you replace the leader yourself, you are refunded the action for replacing them, which means it basically you can swap out your leader without spending an extra action, which really encourages you to switch leaders before the game switches it for you.
Mm-hmm.
It does get a little brutal.
Which is another one of those opportunity things, right? Because if you want to take advantage of that, then you need to pick up a new leader early enough that you'll be able to play them before the age ends.
Yeah. And I think another piece that's good about leaders is that they're all passive bonuses. For the most part, like, you don't have to spend actions on them. They just give you a bonus.
Augment other actions or...
Yeah, and it's kind of like FOMO. Like, oh, I really should use this leader. So I don't want to...
I get this free thing I'm just not using.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it cuts down your decision space on what otherwise is like tons of options in the game. It's like, well,
yeah,
I guess I'm using JS Bach to... I should get a theater.
That's
JS
Bach.
Yeah. Well, yeah, every unsolicited resource is a goal.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we talk about events.
Yes, let's talk about events because events are super cool in this game. Basically how
or political actions.
Well, yes. So political actions allow you to play event cards. And they let you play other things too, like pacts and wars and aggressions and so forth. But event cards, there is a deck of five current events. And another deck, or maybe a stack, of five future events. And as your political action, you can play an event from your hand to the future events, which nobody else sees. Only you know what's coming up. And these event cards can affect everyone, or often they will affect a player who meets a certain criterion, as like... You know, the player who has the biggest military gets to steal stuff from the player who has the smallest military, or
the person with the most victory points gets victory points.
Yeah, exactly. but the thing is, so you put an event on the future deck, and then you reveal an event from the current deck, and this is really cool for a number of reasons. First of all, one of the common problems with event decks, I think, is they can feel very arbitrary because you're just drawing cards and then, oh, okay, it randomly hurt me or it randomly helped me. In this system, the events are not arbitrary. Players have put them into the deck specifically because the players thought that they would benefit from them. But there's a delay, right? So, like, you put the card into the deck, but it doesn't come up until the current events are exhausted, which means by the point in time when the event comes up, you might no longer be the one to benefit most from it. Although you know it's coming, so you probably want to build towards benefiting from it. So it does a really good job of foreshadowing in a way that makes these somewhat arbitrary events feel completely fair because somebody intentionally put them in there. And it also encourages you to draw the cards, because in order to let's say you want to get to an event that you played, you really want it to come up, well, you're going to need to put other events into the future events deck, and they may or may not be events that you are excited about playing. And similarly, if there's an event that you really want to put in the future events deck, well, you're going to have to activate a current event, which might be something that somebody else is interested in. So, because those two things are tied together, like scheduling an event for the future and activating a previously scheduled event, players will often do this in ways that do not strictly benefit them and may benefit other players. And I feel like that creates both chaos and also interaction, like when you activate somebody's event because you need to play one.
Right, yeah. And I mean, I played a card that I knew for sure would not impact me ever and would definitely impact the other two.
And it
did in a very negative way, which was great. But yeah, it's really interesting how you don't know when it's going to come up. And then what you actually get played on that turn is something completely random that you had no idea might even have been in there. And so, yeah, having that kind of delay is really, really interesting. Also, it's tied to military actions or cards that you draw. And so when you're looking at you have civic cards and military cards. Military cards you draw from the deck face down that your opponents don't see, where the civic cards you actually take from the draft conveyor, and they will see that, and that always remains knowable to them.
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting seeing that kind of difference between the military cards and the civic cards. And then even like how some of these military cards are actually like maybe a bonus to defense or colonization or tactics that you can use in order to like make your specific army better for a moment until everyone learns that tactic, and then they can also use it in the future. It's just really interesting how it all kind of starts working together, and how when you introduce something, everyone else can learn from that same thing you've introduced.
Yeah.
Which I kind of wish technology worked a little bit more like that too, because that's very true how that works as well. But that would be convoluted, so I get that.
That technology works like it how?
That if you like play a technology in front of you, that somehow other people could learn that technology.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Because when you're displaying something like that, you're showing the world what you've learned, and they learn from it too.
Right.
Kind of like Dominion Council Room. You know, I get 4 cards, you all get 1 card. Like, I love those little big benefit for the player playing, and then small benefits for everyone else. I think those are really interesting.
Something else that I think isn't kind of fun about this game is they mash up everything from history all into one game. And
yeah,
I was thinking, like, you know, a lot of these card effects are not that different from each other, especially like the governments. Possible governments, so you could replace,
which we haven't talked about a whole lot.
Yeah, you start with what's it called?
Despotism,
and you can upgrade that to like monarchy and so on. And the effect is not that very exciting. It's just, oh, I get another action in civil or another action in military or maybe both.
I'm pretty excited by that.
I mean, it's exciting. More actions are great, but in terms of like the card itself, it's like, oh, one more cube. But I think the fact that there's a name associated with all of these lets you figure out the story in your head of, like, the Kremlin, for example, it gave you some culture points, but it made your, give you a sad face, so your unrest increases. Yeah, so I think that is a huge advantage of putting a theme onto these otherwise kind of abstract games.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one advantage of civilization games, which is that they are very people can identify with them a lot because mm-hmm. you know it's human history and we're all humans, so we all
of us are human.
We can all identify with, you know, all of human history as a theme.
Right.
I guess in terms of like when I say abstract, it's all cards. There's no
right. There's people no moving around
living on a map,
armies or
which is interesting for a civilization world building out kind of game. No map.
Which you normally think of like from a geographical standpoint, right? Like borders and adjacency.
Well, because of the civilization video game, right?
Right. Right.
I think the game does a fantastic job of abstracting away the essence of civilization. Like, I feel like this game does a good job of capturing civilization, the video game, even though there is no map and no concept of space. I feel like it does a really good job of abstracting all of the systems into a spaceless system.
Yeah, like, I agree with that.
There's also colonization. We haven't talked that much about it, but it's basically like an auction. You know, there are colonies that come up as events, and you bid on them with your military units. And then if you get them, it's like a bonus for your empire. And that is how you represent sending out colonists and colonizing other lands, which is a big part of what you need the big map for anyway.
Right. Right.
In civilization.
Yeah. Not to make it all socially political here, but it is interesting thinking about, you know, this was made quite a while ago. And
yeah,
I don't know that a game would get published that straight up has colonization.
Maybe exploration.
Yeah, they'd probably spin it as, we're exploring, or maybe we're colonizing the moon or so on. but I mean, it is a part of history, but it does. It's just interesting thinking about.
Or you'd actually introduce, you know, indigenous people on that place you're looking at and then having a dialogue with them as opposed to just taking over somewhere, like entering trade agreements or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's definitely ways to go about it that aren't take over this person's home.
Well, and it is very explicitly, you know, exploiting these lands for gain. Because, like, okay, you win the colony, great, you get 9 materials. Or
11 victory points. What culture did we find here?
Or you get, like, 2 happy faces.
right.
That's probably not the natives who are happy about that. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. Trevor, you were going to give a takeaway.
A takeaway is what I was going to start looking at after we talked about colonization, which is important to talk about. So for me, what I really love is the improvement of the kind of structures and being able to move workers up them and upgrade them into new structures. So, like, for instance, you have agriculture that can go into irrigation, that can go into selective breeding being animals, not people, just so we're clear. It's not that crazy of a game. But yeah, like every single one of them, it just improves the amount of food resource they make by 1. And so you're able to do these little, like, small movements and improve them, which I think is really cool as you go across the board and just see the different types of buildings. And they can still go in the lower buildings if you don't have enough materials in that turn. And they can produce those, you know, smaller amounts until you have enough money to improve them. So I just think that's a really clever system that... super simple, doesn't take up a lot of space, doesn't take up a lot of brain space. It's very clear. And then also, like, they're based off of symbols, and so you're just looking for that symbol in that track of cards that are coming out. And that just helps you kind of figure out what you want, what you're going for.
Yeah. I mean, I think another really cool thing about the upgrade system is that, you know, the yellow cubes represent people. They represent your workers. Mm-hmm. And it's the same people, but as your civilization develops, the buildings and technologies that you're developing are making them more efficient at their job. So it's like it's like the worker who was, you know, using bronze tools or whatever, now he's a coal miner and you know, he's producing 3 materials per turn instead. And it gives you this feeling that your work, you know, the people just like in real life, people with better tools become more productive, right?
Right.
And then, of course, the capital-owning class captures all the gains from that, which is us in this game.
We are above the classes even. We're almost like this cultural deity guiding this whole civilization.
But yeah, it does feel like your workers are getting more productive, which is really cool.
Right,
how it's all set up. Yeah, I guess so. My takeaway, I think, I had 2 things I was talking about. I already talked about the event cards, which I think that's a really cool system for foreshadowing random events. Except they're not even random; you're putting them in there.
Yeah.
I think what I'll go with actually, though, is going back to the blue cubes. And more particularly to making change as a mechanic, because in this game, when you have multiple levels of technology, like let's say you have a building that produces 1 food, a building that produces 2 food, and a building that produces 5 food, right? And you want to spend 7 food. And you have like 10 food. So 10 food is representable as 2 cubes worth 5 that are 2 blue cubes sitting on the 5 food thing. And you can make change by putting 1 on the 2 and 1 on the 1. And now those 2 cubes represent 3 food. But if you didn't have that 2, to make the change, you would need 3 blue cubes, right? You'd need 3 cubes on the 1. So having these intermediate technologies isn't actually a complete waste, because they're still increasing your storage efficiency because they allow you to make change in certain ways. And I guess more generally, I think having restrictions on your ability to make change for higher denominations is kind of a cool mechanic to have in a game, especially when you can like upgrade your technology somehow to have access to more denominations. Because normally the way that it works is you can just freely exchange denominations of whatever the resource is.
Right.
Like, you know, you have a chip worth 10 and a chip worth 5 and some chips worth 1, and just do whatever you want. And I think it's cool to have the denominations available to you be significant, and the number of tokens that you're using to represent the value be important. So I think that's my takeaway. Making change as a core game mechanic.
Yeah. Well, cool. Anything else on Through the Ages? Or?
I want to play it again. And so, just a heads up for everyone, now that we're at the end of the episode, we played on BGA and we played with some settings on, so we didn't get to play with the full version.
Some settings accidentally on.
Accidentally on. We
didn't
get to
H3. Playing on BGA, fair warning that the default setting is to not play the full game. Because I don't know, maybe because it's quite a long game already.
It was pretty lengthy.
We missed out on the war. It's a very thought-intensive game. Yeah, we missed out on the war stuff, like aggression and wars and pacts.
Yeah.
But those are cool, too.
Yeah. Yeah, so I definitely want to play again now with those settings back on and just kind of play it and see what it's like again, because it's a really interesting game. It would be hard to play the physical copy. I'd be curious if they did try to improve some of those kind of component situations in the future. If they do like a reprint of it, if they do a redo of it at some point. I saw them doing that at one point, but maybe I am imagining that. But that would just be really cool to see what else you can do to just make that a little bit more tighter in terms of how cubes are used, maybe. I don't know how you do it, but it'd be cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, tune in next week for our next civilization building game.
Hey, thanks for listening to The Tabletop Takeaway. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. So please tell your friends and visit our website at thetabletoptakeaway.com, where you can suggest games and mechanics for us to cover next on the show.